Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
And thank you so very much for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, joining me in studio, not sitting beside me any longer, folks. We are trying something different. We threw out the old desk. We've gone back to the way it was old school when we started. Sitting across from me is Ned Flanders.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in Skellington Studios. Yeah, sometimes, you know, you get things right the first time, and then you change it up, you change the feng shui of the room, and it turns out the energy's not as good. So yeah, we're reverting back to the way we used to.
Old school.
In the original studio, we would face each other.
Yeah.
And then we've changed it several times, and so now we're going back to that.
I think it's better.
I think it's better too because I can look you
now. I can look into your beautiful eyes right when you're telling me stories.
Right. Yeah, even though your face is goblin-like,
I have a goblin
story coming up. But I think it works better. Yeah.
It does. How's things been going?
Everything's been going good.
I haven't got to talk to you, but like one day last week, because you were so busy.
Work's finally picked up. It was slow for a while. I was blowing through my savings. It was getting tough, but it picked up. The problem is there's a lag period between when you do the jobs and then you get paid. So I'm still waiting for the money to come rolling in. But it's been picking up. It's been thunderstorms and everything around here. The twins just had a birthday. What else? My mom went to Mexico, so I had to watch Pop-Up for a couple days.
This is Poppy, son of Pop-Up.
Yeah. And so I got to hang out with him for 2 or 3 days. That was pretty fun. We watched Predator. We watched war movies. Yeah. We ate steaks. It was a good time.
He was smoked cigars.
He did. Yeah, he smoked cigars.
Like crazy.
He had a good time.
His mom's gone. You got to get it in while she's not there.
Yeah, he enjoys it.
Hey, another thing.
It's me.
Go Stars.
Yeah, man. Still
don't even like talking
still
about it.
Going. Yes, let's not even talk about it. I don't want to jinx anything that's going on over there. But yeah.
Everybody that's been dealing with the storms, too, our heart goes out to you, man. It came through here some, not as bad as it's been elsewhere. It's been terrible with the swirling wind and the pounding. Your uncle's garden destroyed, the entire thing. That big-ass garden gone from the hailstones, just destroyed every bit of it, man.
Man, my garden's rolling.
Yeah, as long as there's no hail, it'll be... Yours is about to take over half the backyard.
It's about to take off. Everything I can see is coming in, so we're only weeks away from a harvest. I'm sure you'll be getting your salsa starter kit.
Yeah, it'll be popping off, and I'll start making salsa.
Now, I mentioned earlier that your face looked goblin-like.
Yes.
Check this out. It says, I've been struggling with what I saw and whether or not to share it or not.
It's me, baby.
Part of me wants to know if I'm not alone in my experience, and the other part wants to believe it was just my imagination, and I shouldn't attempt to learn anymore.
Which parts are those?
Yeah. On the grand scale of experiences, this probably won't be that interesting to some people, but I'm afraid because of it, and it's what has led me to share this story. Two nights ago, I was in my apartment, Cam, with my one-year-old son. His dad was working the night shift at 1 a.m., so I don't know the exact time this happened, but I'd say between 2 and 4 in the morning. We have a king-size bed, and our son fell asleep with me, so I let him just stay there. At some point, I woke up to the baby rolling around in the bed and was kicking me. Cam, you know how this is. The grandbaby stays over, kicks you all night long, right?
She beats me up.
At the time, I didn't know what his problem was, but he was keeping me awake. This lasted for a while because usually when my son sleeps next to me, he doesn't move so much, and I figured he'd eventually get still. He didn't, though. He kept moving around, half asleep, and I was worried that he'd roll off the bed. I felt like this went on for at least 30 minutes, if not longer, and I got frustrated that I was awake, so I decided to move him to his playpen in the living room. I laid him down and then went to the bathroom. From the bathroom, I could see into the living room. I left the door open, obviously, to watch the baby. I should also mention, at night, it's not completely dark in our apartment, so you can still see fairly well. As I was on the toilet, I looked over to where the playpen is just for a few seconds, and I saw some kind of creature.
Uh-oh.
It was all black and hunched over like it was hiding behind the playpen, but not very well. The playpen is made with the see-through netting. Anyway, you can see right through it. This thing had long arms, and my memory says it was slightly muscular on its upper body. What struck me as off about the whole thing was that it had long, pointy ears like an elf-like creature, but only bigger. I was like, what the heck is that? I finished quickly and rushed into the living room, but nothing was out there. So I walk into the bedroom with the image of this thing lingering in the front of my head. I try to discount it or come up with an explanation, but I don't have one. I know it's natural for people to see faces or human shapes, but this thing wasn't human looking, and I've never seen anything like it. There's no reason my brain would just make this whole thing up while I'm trying to use the bathroom. I'm worried about what it was trying to do to my son. I ended up grabbing the baby, and he slept with me the rest of the night. I wasn't going to take any chances. The next morning, he was sick with a cold, so I'm guessing that's why he was so uncomfortable. But it's been a couple of days now, and I can't shake off what happened. If I had to give this thing a name, I'd say it resembled a large goblin. It had larger than human sized head. I guess I'm looking for input or some kind of advice. Do I pretend that nothing happened? How do I protect my family if this was something paranormal? And what if it comes back? I've had a few unexplained experiences in my lifetime, but anything like this in my own home. This whole thing has me very worried. April.
A goblin.
Something. It reminds me of the stories of like the changelings, where you have these stories of these like troll goblin-like creatures that will come and steal your baby.
And then leave you like a baby made of sticks.
Yeah, something like that. So maybe this thing was trying to abduct her child.
It's Goblo.
Yeah, Goblo Escobar.
That's right.
Right? Ken is a fictional character named Goblo Escobar.
He helps the party. He's in my homebrew campaign I've been running since. When did we start playing? Like Thanksgiving or something,
something like that.
For a hot minute. But yeah, Goblo's awesome. Dude, he's awesome.
What do you got?
I have got something here. You know how much I love to hit you with the headlines, right?
Yeah.
Large, hairy, white-eyed, humanoid beast crosses the highway near Fort Irwin, California. Lawrence sends this in. You're going to get a check out of this. It says, I used to be stationed in Fort Irwin, California. It's a long story, but there's a 30-mile road that leads from Barstow, which is the closest town, into the base, which is a large, empty desert. There are dozens of crosses along the road leading into the base from soldiers and families of soldiers who've had accidents on this road throughout the years. Now, here is a small section of Fort Irwin Road for reference, of course. Now, you got to imagine this at night. So you start thinking about a long, open highway. And when you look at any of these pictures, if you look up this area right there, you got to imagine if you've seen Forrest Gump, when he's running down the middle of the road in the desert and there's kind of mountains and all that stuff. That's what this looks like, rolling, going in towards that base. So you're out in the middle of nothing, basically. So Lawrence goes on to say, a buddy of mine who was a platoon mate and I were driving back from the mall in Victorville one night. As we entered the starting stretch of Fort Irwin Road, I noticed some fresh, bloody tire marks leading off the side of the road directly into a cross, which was dated 8/11 of 2006. Really creeped me out, and I thought I was seeing things. And about 20 minutes into our long drive, this isolated two-lane highway leading into the vast empty desert, I look over to my buddy, who was driving, and lip-syncing to some song. And then, as we're going about 75 miles an hour, something darts out in front of us. I quickly caught a glimpse of what looked like a large humanoid beast with fur and a wet, hairy face. Now, it looked directly at us, even though we were doing 75 miles an hour, and it was running right across his car. This thing was tall, I would say at least 7 foot tall, walking on two legs, but the eyes were like, I really don't know how to explain it. But for a split second, when it turned to look at us, as it turned its body, and I looked into its eyes, it was like time slowed down. Its eyes were white voids, not a reflection. More like dead light. That's a Stephen King reference they write in here.
And it wasn't a look of fear, but its eyes was more of a look of, I see you. It was the most skin-crawling thing I've ever experienced. Whatever it was not human, and it was not an animal, but this thing was sentient. But not like we are. I won't say it had powers, but whatever it did to us when we looked at it, I don't know. I turned to my friend who yelled out, oh my God. Then the thing ran off to the other side of the highway. My buddy thought that we'd almost hit someone, so we stopped and got out to check. But whatever it was ran off into the big empty desert night. And then he began to repeat, large hairy bird. No, not a bird, a bear. No, wait, what was that? It took us about another 20 minutes to get to base. And then we just sat there, music off, not talking to each other. He was quiet, which he never was quiet, not him at all. And I tried to think of what to say, but we were really just too chilled to talk. We got back to base and we told our squad members about what had happened, but no one believed us. That is until a few weeks passed by and I started hearing quiet murmurs from people who didn't want to speak openly. But they said that they too had seen similar sightings. Years later, after I got out of the service, I did some research online and learned about a native folklore passed down by indigenous Native Americans who claimed that Sasquatch was believed to live out in the barren salt flats. So I Googled up a lot of interesting information. But whatever it was, my friend turned white as a ghost that night, and we have never spoken of it to each other since.
Yeah, what's wild about that area?
Well, first of all, how's it going to live out there?
That's what I'm saying.
So
where it's at, it doesn't seem like you'd support something biologically that large. I mean, what was the one where there was like a drag race strip outside of Las Vegas or something? It was in the desert.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was California. And there was several sightings of a Bigfoot-like creature. But you're like, there's nothing out
there. There's nothing out there.
Even Derek, when he went and him.
What was the other one? Yucca Man is the other thing
that
makes me think of Yucca Man.
Yeah, Arizona. I think that's what it was. I think that's the same story I'm thinking of, the drag strip out there in Arizona. But even Dave Flora and Derek Hayes, when they were doing that Borrego Triangle documentary, there's like sightings of Sasquatch-like creatures. And you're like, there's nothing out there.
There's nothing. Nothing.
Nothing that could support an animal that large, a 7 foot tall.
Yeah, and they're going to be giant and hairy with all that heat. They got to be living underground, right? Like, what? It doesn't make sense.
That's why I think it's interdimensional. I don't think it's of this earth. Speaking of Stephen King, have you seen the previews for the new movie, The Long Walk?
No.
Yeah, it looks interesting. Luke,
of course,
hits me up with every horror movie that's coming out. But this isn't a horror movie. This is one of the Stephen King movies that's not a horror movie.
Oh.
Which I've enjoyed several of his that weren't horror.
Like Shawshank Redemption?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
The One.
Yeah.
I have to check this out.
It's not out yet, but it's coming out sometime this year.
Folks, I like to creep us out. When we're in studio, I have Jaws playing on the television. I had a little Kung Fu theater going when he got in there, and I put it on Jaws.
But Kung Fu's not scary. Sharks, definitely scary.
Not a fan.
Speaking of scary, check this out. It says, I live in rural Harrelson County in Northwest Georgia. One night I was taking the dogs out. I was standing on the edge of the patio, and while my senior dog was pulling to go back inside, and I was trying to coax him onto the grass, my pup suddenly lunged forward and was freaking out.
Well, I'm glad we got to the end of that. Now we know who let the dogs out.
Yeah. When I looked up, I saw it. Or at least I'm 99% certain that what I saw was it. It was standing by one of the big trees at the edge of the woods, sort of half hidden, hiding behind it. It didn't really remind me of a Bigfoot all that much, at least from what I was imagined they would look like. Some sort of gorilla / person, right? I tried looking further into it and stumbled upon the Alabama White Thing, since I've just a few miles from the Alabama border. This thing I saw stood about 6 foot tall when I compared it to the branches of the trees. I tend to do a lot of work at those two trees it was standing at. It seemed to have light-colored fur or hair. It was bipedal, but the legs were more like an animal's anatomically. It had fairly long arms in comparison to its body. I didn't really see its face, but if I had to guess, I would say it was very flat, very short snout. I didn't see a tail, but it wasn't all in clear view. This is a description of me laying eyes on this thing for like a few seconds max, as I hurried to drag my dogs back inside the house. Needless to say, I didn't mind one bit that they had had accidents that night and started taking the dogs out into the front yard. I would cross the road with them, but there's more woods over there. I'm speaking of the woods across the road. A week or so after I started going out in the front, it seemed to have caught up on that. And now either I hear it coming from those woods, or at least there's more distance between us there, or from the woods in the back, but further to the left, where I would be visible to him. A week or two ago, I had a friend over for the night because their car broke down near me, and it was Sunday, so it couldn't be towed until the next day. At around 1 a.m., they wanted to get some snacks, and my dogs were being annoying because they didn't get to play that day, so we decided to make a 20-minute walk to a small gas station. But we kept hearing this rustling in the woods, like something was following us. And as usual with this thing, the dogs didn't seem to know whether to lunge out or to run. But when we encounter animals, it's all excitement and wanting to go check it out. Nothing like the fight or flight battle they were having. We had somebody come pick us up at the gas station and drop us off back at home because we feared walking back. I've also overheard a conversation about a neighbor's dog that passed. I've seen her a couple of times, the owner of the dog, and I wanted to ask her about it. She didn't really want to talk. Apparently, they let her out, the dog, that night, and she never came back. That's all I know. For anybody out there who's out in this type of area of Northwest Georgia, if you have anything similar to this, please let me know or let the boys at Expanded Perspectives know. Lori.
Whoa.
So something's in the woods, but the description,
those woods out there?
They said it didn't look like Bigfoot, or at least what they thought Bigfoot would look like. And they give a description, and I can't help myself but think about apes, like an orangutan that got loose. Their description of it is, it sounds like an orangutan. Flat face, long, light-colored hair. You know, I'm not saying it's not a Bigfoot. I'm saying, but there are these cases of animals that just are loose.
Well, I mean, you covered one where it snatched a cell phone.
Right.
And a legit gorilla snatched a cell phone from a dude in a hunting stand.
Yeah, there was a woman that sent that story into Ducks Unlimited, that we read. Yeah.
I'm like, so.
And I've seen several of the trail cams from Florida about the skunk ape. And
doesn't look like an orangutan.
Several of them look like an orangutan to me. And out there in those Everglades, you know how.
It would be awesome to see an orangutan out there.
Yeah, they're very nice.
No, they look cool as heck, yeah.
Right.
What's the one?
Right Turn
like
Clyde,
jungle?
Or what? Yeah. What's that?
That was it. Any Which Way But Loose.
Yeah, he's a Right Turn Clyde
and
or something
just
like that.
Punching people. This orangutan.
Well, let's take a break. You didn't even know. You don't even know what we're talking about.
I have no idea what you said. I have a surprise for you, and I'm like, what? And he's gone into the annals of Expanded Perspectives Elite, and he dug out an old Elite story.
Yeah.
And it's one that I really enjoy, but I had forgotten all about it, folks. So this is going to be, I'm going to get to be as surprised as you will when you get to hear this about some crazy blimp and missing people that I had done several years back. And I think you're going to enjoy it because I did when I did it, and I had totally forgotten until he brought this back up. So let's take a quick one, jump back into that, and then we'll pick it up at the back end. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
All right, guys, let's dig into a crazy blimp story. Blimps are one of those things that I think most of us here in America always remember as being involved with football. I can remember before
I guess the better cameras, the better ways they have it all set up now covering American football. Blimps were always used for a lot of, you know, overhead shots before they had drones, because you could do it relatively silently. You could film, you could move slow. It was kind of like a culmination of things that were really, we were in between being able to do what we wanted to do video wise. And so we could use a blimp. Also remember always seeing like the Goodyear blimp, and then now you see like the MetLife blimp. You see all these blimps, you'll see them, you know, stuff like that during certain parades. There's always these blimp, all kinds of blimp stuff going on, and or airships. I think I like airship better. I don't know. It's hard to decide. If you go back and listen to the episode that we did years ago that Kyle had done about the airship flap, you know, and the mysterious airship of the Sonora Airship Club. They lay you down a lot of wild ideas and a lot of cool stories and things that had happened with this. But I got to looking into this because of what I'm going to cover today. There's a lot of people out there with pilot's license. I'm sure there's a lot of you listening now that have your pilot's license. Here's an interesting little tidbit coming from this year's that was noticed this year. That in all of the United States, according to the Federal Aviation Administration, there's only 128 people that are qualified to fly airships, folks. That's right. Now, they say aside from contractors and experimental pilots, there's 17 of them that are paid to do it full time. And out of those 17, 13 of them fly for Goodyear. Now, that's right. That's right. So the others fly for AirSign, and which is MetLife, DirecTV, all that. They operate all this stuff. It has, and in fact, AirSign has 14 blimps and all these things. I don't know what it is, but I would love to be able to fly a blimp. I would love to say, oh yeah, I've flown a blimp. Now, every time you think of a blimp, or at least most people think of a blimp, they always think of, what was it, the Hindenburg, because of, you know, the fire and the explosion, but they don't use that. That was hydrogen, and they haven't used hydrogen, I think, for over 80 years. They haven't used hydrogen in these blimps. Or Zeppelins. Most of them, they say, are lifted by helium. Most of all the ones now. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is about it. I love the word. They say instead of the Zeppelin, they say, you'll like this, Goodyear, the Goodyear blimp, instead of a Zeppelin, they refer to it as this, a semi-rigid dirigible, which to me just sounds awesome, right? Goodyear has actually been building blimps since 1911. And apparently back in the war, they used them like crazy. There was tons of them used, and they're big. Those of you who aren't aware, go look them up. Look how big a blimp actually is. Like, they are ginormous. Some of them are huge. It's crazy. But something about the whole idea of a blimp used in wartime, I think, is really cool. It's just a really interesting thing. So that's the story that I'm going to get into. So we got to go back in time. We got to go back in time to 1942. And that 1942, on a Sunday morning, so August 16th, early Sunday mornings. Now, I don't know why the military does everything early in the morning. Why don't y'all sleep in a little bit, bro? Why don't you take it down a notch, man? So this is what it is. The Navy had a blimp. And the Navy had this blimp on an island called, are you ready for this? Treasure Island. In the San Francisco Bay. Now, they use these blimps to search for enemy submarines. So, like I said, it was only a few, 9 months, I believe, before this. It was when the United States actually entered into World War II. Now, the Japanese subs had been destroying Allied ships off of the American West Coast. I think they had blown up 6 of them at the time. Now, Japan actually had a combat sub called the I-17, and the I-17 in February of 1942, if you look that up, they actually blew up the largest oil drilling facility in California, if not the largest, one of the largest. So they blew this thing up. So they'd gotten close enough for that. Now, navally wise, it had said that it was the first time the mainland had ever been attacked in the U.S. since the Battle of New Orleans in 1812. So this I-17, of course, had come down through there and blown this thing up, right? So this blimp, they called this blimp the L-8. Now, when I explain this to you, this sounds insane to me. You're talking about a blimp that has 300 rounds of ammunition, 300 rounds of 30 caliber machine gun ammo on it. All right. And then it had two depth charge bombs that weighed 325 pounds apiece on an external bomb rack mounted on the outside of it. So what they would do was float, like you're thinking, over the ocean with glassing, I'm assuming, till they see it. Because, you know, when they don't have anything crazy, I guess more, they may have some radar. I mean, who knows, though, as they float over and they float till they can see the enemy subs. And then they drop these depth charges down and blow up the subs. Now, these sub attack blimps, which is an insane thing to even say, was a 2-man crew. So the L-8 had a 2-man crew. So they get in it, and what they can, they call it the gondola. They get in the bottom right there, and they're ready to take off that morning, right? They're going on their sub hunting expedition. Now, the people in this 2-man crew was a Lieutenant Ernest DeWitt Cody and Ensign Charles Ellis Adams. They were both married. They both had more than exemplary service records in their naval career, and they had been in the Navy for quite some time at this point. Now, Lieutenant Cody was the senior aviator of the Airship Patrol Squadron 32 and was a 1938 graduate of Annapolis. So that alone makes him a pretty legit dude, right? And it even says down through, like, when you have those fellas like that that go through all this stuff, they're like most combat veterans. They don't, you don't rattle them. Most of those guys are, when it, you're rattled before or you're rattled after, but during, it seems like those guys have a way of just dialing in, and it is unbelievable that they can do these things. Just like a lot of first responders, a lot of them, they just, some people have that knack for being able to just at the moment, boom, dial in and everything's good. So what's funny is, if it is funny, is they say that Lieutenant Cody was part of what's called the LTA, the lighter than air flight, right? But they say that he was considered one of the most capable, not just officers, but pilots by all of his peers. They're like, this dude's legit. Now, what's wild is he had only been officially flying in one of these L-8s, one of these blimps, Lieutenant Cody had, for 9 months prior to this. So, and he was 27. Imagine being 27 years old, and now you're in charge of this. You're hunting for subs off the coast of the United States. So, man, that's some pressure. That is some serious, serious pressure. So they get ready to go. Now, he was, right, the boss, right? He's the lieutenant. The other one's the ensign as they go on here. But Lieutenant Cody was 11 years younger than Adams, and he was even less experienced. Lieutenant Cody had 756 hours of lighter than air flight time, the LTA flight time, while Ensign Adams had 2,281 hours. So you got to imagine, between those two men, they can probably lock down pretty much anything, right? Now, there's a story about Lieutenant Cody that goes like this, that said that in 1942, in April of 42, that he had taken an L-8 and he had flown cargo to the USS Hornet before they went over to raid Tokyo. And the story goes that Cody had actually kept that blimp perfectly level and perfectly hovering above the flight deck, or above the carrier's deck on the USS Hornet, while they unloaded over 300 pounds of spare parts for B-52 bombers. And they said that it was extremely difficult given the moving target below, the wind off the sea, the wind above, this whole thing. And they said, so for a fella that didn't have but 756 hours, those 756 hours that Lieutenant Cody had was trial by fire. This guy had went hard in the paint, you know, trying to get all this stuff going, which they say is what led to him being promoted to lieutenant senior grade just a couple months after that. So this whole story goes, yeah, he did this. Because of that, we did that. Now, like we said, Ensign Adams had over 20 years in the lighter than air. Okay. So this fella was no messing around either. He had been, I get a load of these names and I start talking about this. The ZRS-4, the ZR-3, the ZRS-4 is Akron. The ZR-3 is the Los Angeles. And the ZRS-5 is the Macon. Those were all airships, folks. Those are all big dirigibles. Now, he's 38 years old and had been decorated by the German government for rescuing Hindenburg passengers after the airship caught fire and crashed. So this dude has been involved in this his pretty much entire life since he was 18. He spent 20 years of his career dealing with these airships. Now, what's really crazy, and you can only assume or guess when you read things like this, is that some men just are really, really good at their job, but they're not meant to be promoted. They always find a way to go against the grain. They don't play the game. You know what I'm saying? And y'all do. Y'all know exactly. We all know those people. You might be one of those people. I'm one of those people that you're not going to kiss someone's ass just to better your career. You can't do that to yourself. It just will not be. And that sounds like when Ensign Adams, it sounds like that's the kind of man that he was. He was extremely good at his job, was very gifted at what he could do, but it was only, he received his commission for this flight only the day before. So he made his first LTA patrol as an officer on that whole thing. Yeah, Adams did. So that was it. Everything else, he had just been that. Now he's finally going to be an officer. And they gave it to him the day before. So they said before all this, before this whole thing went down, it was still in August. Lieutenant Cody took the L-8, went back out to the Hornet, made another delivery, and then headed across the Pacific, you know, and was just out there doing their whole thing. But anyway, the Hornet was going over to Tokyo, right? That was the whole thing. So they go into this whole deal. Now, the patrol was supposed to take, they were going, this is from what I understand, the way it was going to go, 30 miles west of San Francisco, and they were going to head north to Point Reyes, and then they were going to go to Montara Beach, which is just south of there, and then they were going to make this loop come back to Treasure Island. It sounds like it's a pretty good circle. It's a pretty good area that they're looking. This is the patrol they're taking. But it says it's only going to take them 4 hours. So, you know, I mean, it's not like we're talking about being gone all day. It's a 4-hour little patrol. So, like we said, you know, Cody and Adams, they're going to head out. And they said that they were expected to return no later than 10:30, okay, that morning. That's when they're supposed to go. Well, so this is the thing. And then get a load of this. This was the first LTA unit to be established on the West Coast after Japan's attack on the Pearl Harbor. So they said originally the part of Goodyear's fleet, of course, was advertising blimps, and the L-8, which come from Goodyear. Remember me talking about the Goodyear stuff? The L-8 had actually been bought from Goodyear by the Navy and then shipped over and had been put together in March. So it wasn't built until March. So now, and the L-8 stands for Love. Love 8 was what it stands for. But because she can't be in the military and call it the Love 8. And I know what some of y'all are thinking. Love 8's a good nickname. I get it. But that's not where we're going with this. So it's 150-foot long blimp, this thing was. Now get a load of this. You're not going to... It holds 123,000 cubic feet of helium. That's a lot of squeaky voice in one big bag, isn't it? Little high-pitched squeaky voice. Ooh, you think those guys ever like took a little hit off the helium? Hi, everybody. You know, you think it's something like that? That'd be hilarious trying to fly around and be serious. We're going to drop bombs, you know, and you got all the crazy voice. So, I mean, it would travel 43 knots at its maximum speed. Now, this is my favorite thing here. Warner Super Scarab Type 5 engines. It had twin 145 horse Warner Super Scarabs. I don't know what that is, but if you say it fast and it sounds awesome. Like if you said, oh yeah, what's that old car got under the hood? Oh, I got two twin Warner Super Scarabs. People would believe it. You know, especially if you got some, I'm not a car guy, but if y'all are car guys and you got somebody that doesn't know, drop that on them. And they're going to be like, oh yeah, I got put a new supercharger on my Ford. It's a Warner Super Scarab, and just see what they do. It'll be great. So Goodyear had said that this was one of their best flying airships. Like, this thing is the one. Like, you want the easiest to fly, the you know, the best holding. Everything about this airship was thumbs up. Like, it doesn't get any better than this. And so this is the reason that it is. And it also requires very, very minimal maintenance at all. So this thing is like the go-to for all of this LTA stuff. And you're going to get a kick out of this. The LT8 models had been used in over 1,000 trips while it had been flying, and they have flown it numerous times, right? So the pre-flight check goes down, and Cody and Adams do their pre-flight, but instead of the day of or the day before, they do it 4 days prior. Not that that matters, but, you know, most pilots always do their pre-flight right before they take off. It's just the thing you do, or at least the same day. You know, I'm sure there's some done in the evenings or the day before, but 4 days, I don't know. But anyhow, so the story goes along like this. Everything's working great. The L8's the best thing that they got. It's packing twin 145 Warner Super Scarabs. So they get ready to go, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning. The L8 takes off, right? So they hit up. Cody and Adams take off out of there. Now, Cody's flying it, and I'm sure Adams is just kicking around whatever he has to do. I don't know how the co-pilot would work on that whole deal. But they said that it was the winds were very light that day. So, I mean, everything was working out great. They said the winds were only like 4 knots an hour. They're only going to get up to between 800 and 1,000 feet. Now, they did say that it was a little overcast, but they were happy because they could see visibility was very good out to about 5 miles. And it's reported that Cody even said that he could see the towers on the Golden Gate Bridge in the distance. So they knew that they could really see a lot of the ocean that way. So they were going to get up there, going to get a good view. Now, they said the mission itself was so they could travel a 50-mile radius, okay? So that was the size of the holding. So 4 hours, 50 miles. Hey, that's pretty good, I would think. So they start making their trip, right? Start doing their thing. About an hour and a half into the patrol, Cody radios in, and they're 4 miles east of the Farallones, those little islands out there. So they're like, hey, man, everything's going great. Says 4 minutes later, he clicks over again. He said, hey, I'm investigating a suspicious oil slick. Please stand by. Now, instantly, everybody's get their pulse up, right? Cody's hands are sweaty. Adam's hands are sweaty. Like, we are rocking and rolling, because they said lots of times an oil slick means there's a sub there. You know, you got to think back in the day, maybe they didn't have the best stuff, the whole thing. And so they drop some, right? So the story says the L8 sees the oil slick, checks it out, drops one of the bombs. Boom. Well, I say it's a smoke producing thing. Like they said, it's like an aerial bomb. So it's like, I guess, an aerial marker. So they drop it so other people can fly by and see it. Like, here's the oil slick. This is where we last saw it. You might want to come by and check it out. They're not really blowing stuff up just yet, but this is all taking place about 7:30 or so while they're kicking around there, you know? And so they, you know, they're checking this whole thing out. They said that one of the other ships seeing that on the water coming up off of there. So they let them know, hey, look, we see an oil slick off your bow 2 miles. So maybe there's one there. Who knows? So there's another ship, and this other ship sees it, right? And they start sounding the alarms, and they get on their guns. And they said that there were some sailors on a fishing trawler there, and they said that they were afraid that the blimp was going to drop its bombs right there on a sub. So they're out there. Can you imagine this? Can you imagine you're out there fishing? You got your nets out, you're fishing, and there's battleships around you. There's blimps dropping stuff in the water, and you're just like, I'm just trying to get by, bro. And there's all kinds of craziness. I mean, I can't even imagine living like any, when civilians are living in a war zone, like even today, it's the craziest thing to me to try to think about going about your day with this going on around you. Like, I'm just trying to get by, y'all, which tells you just how really insane war really is, how crazy it is to even have war. But anyhow, so the story says, no, they didn't drop any bombs, but Cody and Adams did stay close there over that smoke where they had dropped it and just circled and circled and circled for an extra hour. They would not go. They stayed in that whole area just zigzagging, working their grid patterns, looking to see if they could find anything. And you know, if they found something, they're probably going to cut loose on it. That was the whole thing. Well, the name of the fishing trawler was Daisy Gray. And they interviewed these men, and you're going to find out why. So they interviewed the first mate on the Daisy Gray, and he said, man, I could see the two fellas in the gondola. You know, we were close enough. We could see them, you know, the whole thing. He said, I could even tell one of them was dark headed, the whole thing. Now, they did say that the identification had been removed. So, you know, all this, but that it was still painted on the outside of the little cabin there. But he was, you know, they're talking about, and I guess back then more people knew what blimps were because they were more used. But the crew of the naval ship and of the fishing trawler were looking through the binoculars, and they said at one point the blimp's only like 200 or 300 foot up, and it descends down to where it's only 30 foot above the water. So obviously they said the crew and that blimp. So you got to imagine what that must be like. You're controlling the height of a balloon, basically, above the ocean, up and down, trying to take a look at something, up and down. They said, so they get down there. They said, by this point, it's reported they're seeing the blimp like 30 foot above the water at 9 a.m. All right. And then they say, then it rose back up. It rose back up and turned around and started making its way towards San Francisco. And they said nobody thought anything was really out of the ordinary because apparently blimp patrols up and down the coast of California and San Fran was no big deal. This happened all the time. And like we said, this L8 was all out there, the whole deal. So they see them come down over the water. They see it lift back up. They see it turn. They see it head off towards San Francisco. And at that point, when the trawler sees it leave and the battleship out there sees it leave and they watch through the glasses, they watch the men take off and get going away from them. They don't think anything else of it. They go about their day. Was the last time that Lieutenant Cody and Ensign Adams was ever heard from or ever seen again. They're gone. The last message that they ever received was at 7:42 when they were talking about the oil slick. They never called in anything else again. That was it. Control back on land tried to reestablish radio contact with them. Nothing. The squadron headquarters, they wasn't told of the blimp's silence at all until 8:20. And they said, now, it wasn't unusual for blimps to lose contact with their squadron or their wing control or their squadron control while they were out there patrolling. And they said, too, that the men had more than enough fuel to return to base. But they said by 8:50, the L-8 still hadn't responded. Now, mind you, I said around 9 o'clock, they were seen right low above the water, and then they took off. So control sent out two aircraft. They said, we need to go find this thing. If something's happened, you know, make sure the blimp's okay. Maybe it's just the radio's out, something along those lines. So they send them out. These float planes take off looking for the blimp. At 10:49, there was a Pan American Clipper pilot said, I'm seeing the blimp, and it's over the Golden Gate Bridge. He said, there's nothing wrong with it. Says it appears to be under control and appears to be headed back to base. At 11 o'clock, one of the float planes says they see the L-8 3 miles west of Salida Beach, and then it's rising through the overcast up to 2,000 feet. Then he reports a few minutes later, now it's descending, disappearing down through the cloud bank, going down. It says at this point, nobody witnessing this. Now, they still couldn't reach them. They've been trying to reach them nonstop. Couldn't reach them. They said at this point, no one said by what they were watching fly in this blimp that would lead them to believe that no one was in control. They said this whole thing. They said the altitude where the valves would automatically open. Now, get a load of this here. 2,000 foot was the blimp's pressure height limit, okay? So they would automatically open to vent helium to prevent it, of course, it from busting the blimp. Allow them to drop down. They said, now as it goes, the story goes like this. The crewman could avoid suppressing this pressure height problem, going through all this stuff. So undoubtedly, they ignored whatever it was, this whole thing. So at this point, they're like, well, it still seems to be flying in the right direction, just went a little high. Now they're coming back down. They're like, well, why would they, you know, you're not going to spot what you're looking for at 2,000 feet. You know, and they know that. That's why they said their ceiling was 1,000. They have a 1,000-foot buffer in between there. So something's a little odd, but, you know, it's no big deal. It's just something that's going on. And there was an Army P-38 pilot, and he was out near Mile Rock, and he saw the L-8. He said at this point, he noticed something wasn't right, because he said he was assuming that it was to be headed towards Treasure Island. So there was an off-duty seaman that was going to the beach with his family that day, right? And he's going and he was like, yeah, I'm going to go down to the beach. He's driving along the coastal highway there between San Mateo and San Francisco. His name is Richard Quam. Now, Mr. Quam says he sees the L-8 in the distance, and he notices that it's bent in the center. So he even takes a picture of it. Now, that photograph would soon be taken away by the military authorities after he got it all done, right? At 11:15, that was 5 hours after the L-8 left Treasure Island, they see it approaching Ocean Beach there in San Francisco, a mile south of Fort Funston. Now, they said that there was some people on the beach, and one of them was noticing, they said that the blimp was about 50 feet offshore, the motors were completely silent, and that it was sagging in the middle and moved in the wind, like left to right. It was moving, so there's nothing really powering it. It's just barely staying afloat like a balloon, and it's only 50 foot above the water. So it's right offshore and right off the water. That person reported that it went ahead and touched down on the beach, slid inland until the gondola hit the hill, and then the whole starboard engine full of dirt, everything, it just wadded up and bent all the propellers. They said it also knocked one of the depth charges loose. That rolled down, come to a stop. So there's 325 pounds now off of it. It rose again, picked it back up off the ground, and it kept floating. Now, there were some golfers there at the Olympic Club in San Francisco. They watched this bent, crippled blimp float past them. They're out there teeing her high and letting her fly, and they're like, we got a problem, yo, as this thing starts coming. They said what they didn't know is that this depth charge could only be detonated, of course, under the pressure of water. So, you know, no big deal. It's not like it's going to fall and hit the bomb. It's over the ground now. It's no biggie. Now, this is where it gets really, really strange. There was a boy that worked there at the golf course, a 17-year-old boy named Taylor. Taylor had binoculars, and Taylor pulled his binoculars up. And Taylor goes on to say that I could see people inside the cabin. I was glassing it, and I could see there was figures inside the cabin. Now, along this time, too, everybody is catching the idea of this, right? So they are getting first responders out there. People are moving out. People are giving, you know, checking it all out. Firemen are getting involved. There's firefighters coming in. There's police coming in. Because this thing is going into town now. This thing is just barely floating, apparently completely out of control, and heading into downtown. Daly City. It's two blocks south of San Francisco's county line. Yeah, is where this L-8 is going. And it is so low, it starts bouncing off the roofs of some of the homes in that area. Then, as it starts hitting one, a woman there, Miss Appleton, grabs her daughter, and they start running out of through there because they're afraid because it's dragging this stuff across the roof. So, I mean, what are you talking about, 20 foot up? As it's hitting this stuff as it comes down through there. There's other stories of people that were washing their cars, said they noticed it, you know, crashing and dragging stuff down, bouncing down through there. And finally, at 11:30 a.m., it stops at the 400 block of Bellevue Avenue. And when it comes to a stop, some firefighters get there. They start running up there. One of the firefighters interviewed said that you couldn't have lifted it down any easier than it dropped onto Bellevue. But other people are like, nah, not really, because what caused it to fall down slowly was that it hit a utility pole. It smashed nose first into a utility pole. And when that happened, since it was already really kind of broken in the middle, you know, lack of air, it swung the back end towards the front end and kind of doubled it. And then it just set down kind of like a broken football, just boom, boom, and set down right there. They said, what's really interesting, though, is that the fuel supply line to those engines never ignited, even through all the sparks of tearing through electrical lines, through all of this stuff. It never set fire. Nothing. It just, now the funny thing is, this is a funny thing. There was a fella in his yard that was waxing his car. Okay. Been washing and waxing his car, you know, getting him a big, good looking ride out there. And that's the utility pole that it hit was in front of his house. And then it crashed on top of his car, landed right on top of that. So, I mean, look, it's not funny, but damn sure is funny. So, you know, it's dented the hood, beat it all up. They said it busted a taillight, stuff along those lines. So everybody there says, hey, look, we got to get to it. So the guy, the guy whose car was smashed up, his next door neighbor was a volunteer firefighter. Okay. So he comes running out and he's going to help out with the people. He knows something's going on in the gondola. We got to get to him. So he gets up there. And this fella's name is Mr. Morris. So Mr. Morris runs in there and he climbs up into the gondola and he says that the door is open, but there's nobody even inside the gondola. Now, mind you, just a few minutes before, the kid reported seeing people through his binoculars in still in the gondola, seeing people inside. So there's another firefighter shows up. Like I told you, all the firemen are getting there. This fella's name is Thomas O'Brien. Thomas O'Brien runs up, gets in there, and he's like, the door of the cabin was latched open. There's nobody in it. Now, he says there's a microphone for this loudspeaker system so they could, you know, communicate to the surface ships so they can just, you know, they're loud micing it down through there. They said it's just dangling outside. So everybody surrounds it. They make sure they get everything shut off. Nothing's going to catch on fire. Everybody's trying to get the crew out. There's no sign of them. No Adams, no Cody, no nothing. So, of course, what do? They have to set up a perimeter. They have to get the Navy to come in to try to get this bomb off because everybody's still freaked out. They don't realize, a lot of them don't realize it's a depth charge, but they still want to get it off of there. They get it all gathered up. Then they have to send out that very same day, that afternoon, a few hours later, they send 50 men from an Army post and 40 men from the Naval Air Station, and they all get together to go find the one that fell off that caused it, the depth charge that fell off. They all gather up together and they all have to go out on a treasure hunt to find where that one was at. That's how they found out about the dude on the beach that had seen it, you know, that said, hey, look, I know where the bomb is. It's right there. It fell and rolled down. And that's what allowed them to get hired. So they start piecing these stories together. Now, along this whole time, getting into later on in the afternoon, now, mind you, it was 11, a little after 11 when it crashed. They get the other depth charge by 2 or 3. They still can't find the guys. Nothing. They don't understand where they could have been. They said, look, between all the planes and all the ships and all the people on the ground, somebody would have seen them. If they'd have fallen out, the ships would have seen them. The fishing trawler was right there. The planes flying over would have seen them. Where are they at? Something's not there. Now, there were some things come back out, too, that was not true, of course. Some people said that they had, you know, had found food on there. Some people said that they had found, you know, other things on the whole deal and that stuff wasn't working. And that's not true. They didn't find anything. It was literally like they had vanished into thin air. And here's an even crazier thing. The radio that they were afraid wasn't working was working just fine. When they got the blimp back, it was working. No problems at all. Nothing. The thing that really got them crazy was that the life raft, of course, is still on there. And the two parachutes for the men on there in case they have to jump because things are bad. Well, those are still on there. Well, I say two. I think there was actually three, if I remember right. I think there was three. But let's just say two. I think they always put an extra one. But anyhow, so they're all still on there. Now, they did say that, of course, they give them smoke bombs, right? And there's a set number of smoke bombs, 5 or 6 smoke bombs. A couple of those were missing, but they also said they were missing because that's what they used to mark the oil slick. So there's really nothing out of the ordinary. Nothing too crazy is there. Everything was there. They even found they have a lockable, you know, briefcase that locks in behind their seat that talks about their mission, you know, their mission statement and all that stuff and all that. That was all on there. They said what's even wilder is, of course, aside from the props getting beat up and all this, that the engines worked perfect. They'd start, run the whole deal. They even said that the ignition switches were on, all the flight controls operated normally, and it still had 4 hours of fuel remaining in the fuel tanks. So they said what they're trying to get to is they go out for a 4-hour trip. They have 8 hours worth of fuel. What they're trying to get at is they was absolutely zero mechanically wrong with that that blimp. Nothing. Nothing at all. So they don't understand it. They said now two of the three life jackets that were on board were missing. But what's part of the thing is they're not really surprised about that because it's mandatory that they wear the life jackets when they're patrolling over water. So if you do happen to fall out, something happens, the whole deal. Now, they did say that what was a little odd were that the batteries on the blimp were completely drained and that part of the fuel supply had been dumped. They said a blimp wouldn't normally dump fuel unless it's to increase buoyancy, like to, you know, to ballast out, to take off and get higher in a hurry. And they're like, so there's really no reason for that to do. And they said, so they don't know why the engines were idled back and they don't know why you would have dumped fuel. There's no reason. So the Navy gets to going crazy, right? They start sending everybody out looking for these things. They're looking for these guys like crazy. They're, you know, they're like, look, we have to find them. What's going on? So for the next 3 days, they've got ships out there patrolling. They've got planes looking. They got the Coast Guard out there after it. And they said, what's really odd is the seas were extremely calm and the visibility was extremely good. So it's not like we have with the missing 411. This is actually going in their favor. They have to notify the wives. They're like, hey, look, they're listed as missing. We cannot find them. So like, well, maybe they've been attacked. They're like, well, the chance of there being an attack and not one ship or plane seeing them being attacked is impossible. One of us would have seen it. As Mitch is out here patrolling, looking for that sort of thing, is trying to see it. So 2 days after all this stuff goes down, right? They can't find anybody. They've looked, nothing. 2 days after it all goes down, the Navy, they convened their board of investigation, right? They took a 7-day look into the testimony for this. There was a civilian and naval personnel, and they start looking into this whole thing, trying to find out what's going on. Did something happen? Did something get shot at them, and we did not see it? No. They go across everything. They're like, no, there is no damage to this vessel, this L-8. There's nothing. So that's whenever they find out all the people, all the crew that was aboard the Gatlin, which was the battleship, all the crew that was aboard the trawler, the Daisy Gray I told you about. They start talking to them and they said, hey, look, we were watching with our glass, our binoculars. We're in the same area that this submarine that they were, you know, apparently had marked and looking for. Nothing. We didn't see anybody. We didn't see anybody fall out. We would have seen them. We were watching them until they turned and took off. Like, so, no. They're not far enough offshore that they wouldn't have washed up. They, you know, somebody would have seen them if they would have come out even in their life jackets. They called 35 witnesses. They could still find no answers of all the people they interviewed that was involved in something with that blimp that day. Nothing. Now, they don't understand why they went radio silent. They also don't understand where they could have gone mid-flight. You know, that's the biggest thing. And they also want to know what happened between the time they radioed in on the oil slick and when it first hit the beach at 11:15. There's a whole thing. Now, some people claim this. Some people claim that while they lowered down low enough, now get a load of this, that they were actually doing like espionage for the Japanese and that they jumped overboard and then hid out in their sub and went, you know, the whole thing. And then they went to work for the Japanese. And people are like, come on now, that's a little bit much. You know, now we're, so there's all these stories. Another one is one killed the other one over a girl and threw his body into the water. And then during this whole thing, and then, you know, then he fell overboard. And then another one was like, well, when we didn't see it, it may have, you know, the wind may have whipped it and threw them both out and they both died. There's all these crazy ones. And then, of course, they have to throw in the fact that maybe they were abducted by aliens, that while they were up there, they were taken by aliens. That's been thrown around. Nobody seems to really know what's happening. They've had all these investigators go over this for years now, There's even a website that a fellow named Otto Gross has, and he has a theory. He's had a website on all this stuff, and he's done all this research, and he believes that they were actually doing some experimental radar testing, and during this time, it was they were using microwaves to test this radar, and that because of that, they didn't know that people couldn't be around it without it being a certain protective box or a certain protective shielding or covering behind them, so that these microwaves actually may have contributed to the men's demise, and that they had fallen overboard while they were using it, maybe as they were getting lower or whatever they were doing, and it was a bother. And then, you know, there's never been any proof of that, but that's a really an interesting way to look at it, that way of maybe, you know, that the reason they quit talking is because it made them kind of like infrasound. It affected them and this whole deal. There are a ton of them. It all still seems like most of the theories are that they set the engine latch. They set it on idle so they could make their circles as they were looking overboard, trying to glass, and that maybe one fell overboard and the other was trying to help him. And he fell overboard also. And that was the reason that they were dropping the smoke bombs, and maybe that's what they were doing, as they were trying to mark it, and then he was trying to help them before calling it in, and the other one fell over. But a lot of people don't believe that, because they were like, well, but we saw it rise back up and turn and then head back in the direction it was supposed to go. So they're like, you know, and they're talking about all these things, and they're like, well, why wouldn't you throw your smoke bomb out and then throw the safety raft out so the man could get that if you were in there, and then go and radio in, so that way you would always have everything going on. And then some say, well, that the motors weren't set into idle, that they were actually shut off and they were floating there in this whole thing. And that's the reason that the radio was unplugged, is that he was trying to hang out the door and trying to make radio calls and help his buddy. But my thing is, if you fall 30 foot into the ocean and you have a life jacket on, what's the rush, folks? Well, I mean, why not just grab the radio, go, hey, look, we got a man overboard. I mean, you know, there has to be an SOP that you follow, especially in the military. They do not vary from that. So there has to be something along those lines that would make them follow a certain order. So some of this doesn't sound, it almost sounds like they were both maybe whipped over at some form or fashion, right? Something crazy had to have happened. They were declared legally dead a year later, classified as 100% unknown. I have no idea, right, of what's going on. Like I said, there's tons of these. What happened to the bodies? If they drown, you know, were they eaten? I mean, what did sharks get them? What actually happened? There was nothing. Nothing was found. Nothing was seen, even in all of that. I mean, like, it was like the water just swallowed them up. They know they had on, life jackets and all this. Now, here's an interesting thing. They say that after the war, that, of course, when they got Japan's intel, that they started going back, and the Navy even looked into this date. They even went back to sea, and they said that there was no activity that they could find that the Japanese were even in that area doing that. And they found it in other areas, of course, around the U.S., but not that they were in that area during the time of the disappearance. So they couldn't even find that. They couldn't even link it back after all those years. They couldn't say, hey, look, war's over 3 years, 4 years ago. Let's see if they were in this area. Nah, nothing's there. So still, as of right now, nothing makes any sense. Nothing makes any sense of the radar. Nothing makes any sense of the fact that maybe they tried to go. Why would you want to go AWOL? You've been in the military for 20 years. Now you want to get out? I'm like, you could leave now. You're 38 years old. You know, why would you want to go like that? This other guy, he's left. Why would you go to Annapolis and then decide you're going to go AWOL? Like, you've made this your career. Now you want to run out? Like, something, these things don't sound fair. It also doesn't even sound like the two men, it sounds like they got along. Why would they want to fight this, that, and the other? Now, there is a strange theory that there was a stowaway on there, and that this stowaway murdered them and then disappeared. You know, then he got away. But I'm like, where would he go? Why would he kill them? There's no blood. You know, there's no nothing. Like, it, some of these stories make zero sense. This is a really interesting thing, though. After all this time and all this, you know, research and all the stuff these guys have done looking into this story, the Navy released, out of their Board of Inquiry, released a statement saying this, that careful analysis of the evidence indicates no reason for voluntary abandonment of the airship. The board therefore believes that the abandonment was involuntary. So they don't believe the men just bailed out. They believe that something happened and caused them to to maybe be knocked out or washed out of the blimp. I don't know enough about it. I don't know if there would be any water, any residue, anything after all the crash. Who knows? I have any idea. But either way, this is a story that makes zero sense. Now, yeah, they're miles offshore, stuff like that. Maybe they did fall overboard. Maybe they did whip out there and drown. Who really knows? Either way, it makes no sense. I hope you enjoyed the story. I enjoyed telling it. Let's take a quick break and we'll wrap it up. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives Elite.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
And there we go.
There we go. Right? And we're back. Yes.
We do so many stories, and then people will email us about stuff from years ago. And I'm like, I don't know. And then I got to go and I go in and look around and then I can't find it. We don't remember topics. We don't remember music. There's so many things, right? First of all, Kyle and I aren't that smart, so y'all have to bear with us.
Hard drive's full.
Hard drive is more. And I don't even know if I have I think I'm more of like a megabyte hard drive. I don't even think I have gigabytes in my hard drive.
Yeah, it is. I've even when we meet people in person, they're like, man, do you remember on this episode you told this story and said what? I'm like, no. I'm so sorry. I really don't.
I wish I did.
And if you go back and listen to something from like 7-8 years ago, it's like an out-of-body experience. I'm literally listening to myself tell me a story that I don't know.
That's what I like most about it.
It's insane.
Like I'm telling myself a story and I don't remember anything about this story. It's a different human being telling me.
Well, and what's getting creepy is if on social media and stuff, all this AI technology.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there are videos, and it looks like it's a press conference of, like, Mikko Rantanen giving a press interview saying horrendous stuff about the Colorado Avalanche, and it's not real.
Yeah, it's not real.
And I know it's not real, but if you look at it.
You would think so, yeah.
If I said that to my mother, she would think it was real.
Dude, don't even bring that up.
I'm just saying.
I mean, come on.
Because she sends me stuff sometimes, and I'm like, yeah, that's pretty cool, but you know that's AI, right? And she's like, do what? I'm like, Mom, that's not real. But it's scary. And that line is
us.
As it goes on, AI, in 7 or 8 more years from now, I don't know that you will be able to tell, right?
Yeah, I don't know that you will. I think what's going to end up happening is AI is going to have its own thing, kind of like when you have mass-produced artwork, mass-produced cutlery or anything, pottery, and then there's going to be like, this is real humans doing it.
Okay, I'm a crazy person.
I know.
And you want to hear something I do that's absolutely crazy?
Here we go.
I don't even know why I'm revealing myself.
First of all, it's not just one thing that you do.
No, I know.
That leads to you to
be
absolutely
crazy. I'm going
to
give somebody some insight to my brain. I'm an insane person.
Well, it's been damaged multiple times. We've covered that in the past.
It was damaged before anything happened to it.
At birth. Before anything happened, you were the man that ran headfirst into a parked tractor when you were a child, knocking yourself unconscious for one reason, because you were too busy looking down at your new shoes.
Yeah, I wanted to see how cool they look when I was running. Anyway, so check this out. I'm so crazy, Cam. Whenever I use AI.
Oh, God.
Whenever I use AI to help me write something, like, I don't say, for instance, ChatGPT. That may not be the one. I use several different AIs. But whenever I do that and it helps me, I always thank it. It's like, is that helpful? And I'm like, yeah, please, thank you. Because in my mind, if the AI overlords ever take over, I'm going to be like, I was really nice to you. Yeah, I was really polite.
Man.
So I'm polite to AI. Just in case.
No, they're going to kill me. I don't.
Have you heard the theories about the internet's already over?
Yes.
Like AI is already, everything you see and read on the internet is, it's false.
AI has changed it already.
Yeah.
I think we're living in the Matrix now.
100%.
I think it's already been done. When we wake up, it's going to be like it was in the show where everything's going crazy. We're like, we've been in this whole time. Like,
isn't that crazy? Well, maybe that's what happens when you pass away.
Maybe it is.
When you pass away, you wake up like you like wake up in a dream, and all of this was a dream.
Oh, well.
Or a simulation.
I'm so mad.
I wish my simulation was better. That's why I think AI. Maybe they'll change it. My fortunes will change.
Boy, listen to him. He's trying everything he can. Speaking of trying, I got something you would try not to see. But you know how much I like finding odd things just for you. Lon hooked me up again. A white, pony-sized, lion-faced canine.
Okay.
Seen crossing the road in Olean, New York, y'all. Get a load of this. He dropped it in and it says, I'm contacting you about a creature that I saw and no one believes me. I once saw this giant white dog that had a lion-type face. It was
like a chow dog.
Yeah, exactly. It was 3 a.m. while I was driving home from a relative's house up in the boonies of upstate New York in Olean. My husband was driving and I saw it first and didn't say anything because I figured it was just a large dog. But its movements were very slow and creepy. And after we had passed it, he asked me if I saw it and what the hell that was. I was walking really slowly to cross the street, which was odd because it was 3 a.m. and I don't know who would let their enormous dog out that late in their front yard. And it was headed towards the other side of the road, which is just a small area of forest and then a lake. Normally, when you have your brights on and approach an animal, they would look up and run away. But this one just looked straight ahead and kept walking just as slowly. Anyway, it could have been a really big dog, but it was definitely creepy and seemed abnormal. Now, this was a little over 12 years ago, and we still bring it up when we all get together occasionally. See?
Mm.
So, again, it could be a big dog. Now, the reason I tell this story is I think back to when we always talk about old stories and things that we had heard. What is Jerry Clower?
Okay.
You remember the old storyteller, Jerry Clower?
Yeah.
All the old stuff talked about Marcel Ledbetter and all this.
Yeah.
You remember that he tells a story in there about one of those guys in this that he's got in his stories had cut this dog to look like a lion.
Yes.
Sheared it all up, right? And he runs into the church or whatnot screaming, it's a lion, or his dad screaming, there's a lion in the yard, there's a lion in the yard, all this stuff. The dad gets mad, tells him he needs to go pray to God for being a liar and all this stuff. And he comes back out and he says, God spoke to him. And he said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, God told me when he saw that dog, he thought it was a lion too. And that was all. And I always think about that when I see these stories, because I've seen dogs like this where you could, if at night, easily mistake them for something that they are not.
Yeah.
Just simply due to the haircut. I've seen where people have, you know, they shear their tail down and leave the puff of hair on the end. They cut a mane in them, right? Like this, it makes them look. I mean, hell, my mother had a dog that had a mohawk for the longest time. She always had it cut into a mohawk form. I didn't think it was a punk, right? But
yeah.
It would be easy to say, hey, look, I think I saw a white lion, but it more than likely is like a Great Pyrenees
yeah,
maybe, right. Somebody cut into it, something along those lines.
Man, I'll tell you, the closest I ever came to being attacked by a dog was a chow.
Oh, yeah.
When this was like in the late 90s. I was doing my job.
Almost got you.
I went to, it wasn't abandoned. It was a mobile home that no one was living. It was vacant.
Yeah.
Right. And I was doing the appraisal. At the time, I was playing hockey a lot. And so I was in my
old, in shape to run.
I was in my red pickup truck.
Oh, yeah. The hard body.
And luckily, in the bed of that pickup truck, there was two or three hockey sticks. I'm talking like the old Sherwoods, Titans, thing like that. Well, anyways, I pull up to this house. I get out. I am totally not aware. The skirting around the mobile home, there's a hole. And out from that skirting
comes a monster.
A giant chow dog. And I mean, it's on a beeline and it's hot.
Uh-oh.
I had about 2 seconds to figure out what to do. And I reached in the bed of that truck and grabbed that hockey stick. And I hit that dog on the top of the head as hard as I could. It ran off. I don't know if I killed it. I don't know.
It was coming.
I mean, it looked like Cujo. Like it was going to attack me. It was not happy.
It had made its home there.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was rabid. I have no idea.
Could have had pups underneath. You have no idea, but you're like, it's coming for me.
It's scary now for me to even think about it. But yeah, That was my experience with the chow dog.
You'd be out there all alone by yourself, get mauled by a chow.
Yeah, literally. What would I do? Because I think that was, that was like a small Nissan pickup. So even if I jumped in the bed, it probably could have jumped in the bed with me.
Yeah.
Jeez. Scary, scary story.
It's so crazy.
Speaking of scary stories, if you got scary stories, folks, or interesting stories, or bizarre, whatever you want, you can send them to the show. You can send them to us. Email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show, 888-393-2783. That's 888-393-BRUD. And don't forget, if you want to help us out, you can write and rate, review the show on any platform you listen to. And if you want more, you can go to our Patreon, Expanded Perspectives Elite.
If we get this setup figured out within the next week or so, we'll start doing some more videos in here.
Yeah, we have all the cameras and lenses and stuff. We're just trying to figure out the right setup. And we're probably moving studios again around the end of the year. So we got a couple months away, and then we'll be redoing that. Maybe I'll be able to make a pretty cool, interesting set. Let's not forget about our wonderful sponsors, Surfshark. Go to surfshark.com/expanded or use our promo code expanded at checkout to get 4 extra months of Surfshark VPN. I can't talk. And let's not forget about ZocDoc.
Mustache too big.
Yeah, right. That's why you call me Ned Flanders.
That's right. The Flanders.
ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare high quality in-network doctors and click to instantly book an appointment. Stop putting off those doctor's appointments and go to ZocDoc. That's ZocDoc.com/EXPANDED to find and instantly book a top-rated doctor today. Cam?
Yeah.
What have you got planned for the rest of your week?
Staying out of trouble and doing whatever I'm told.
Good for you.
It's the best thing for me. I've got a bunch of little odds and ends stuff, but yeah, it's better if I'm just like, you got it. Take
Sharp,
care of some things.
Luke's getting out of school this week for school, summer. So I don't know what we got planned. I'm sure he's going to have something for me. I know he's already got a movie picked out Thursday night for me to watch with him. So.
Oh, nice.
So
yeah, that's coming up, the whole deal.
Yeah, I don't think we really have any plans this next week, but I'm sure that'll change.
Nothing too crazy planned this summer.
No, I don't think we're going anywhere this summer. No, I lied. We might go to Florida. It's not 100%.
I got you. Well, I know you and I are probably going to go to Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah. We got to go see our boys and ninjas down there.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Go hang out and do a little fishing.
All right, everybody. I hope everybody out there has a good week. Till next time, I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.
Choose a meal deal with McValue, the $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.